Welcome to the Times of Israel's daily briefing. Today is Tuesday, April 2nd, day 179 of the war with Hamas. Amanda Borchel-Dan here with our military reporter Emmanuel Fabian and religions and diaspora reporter Kanan Lidor. Thank you both for joining me.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Seven aid workers with the World Central Kitchen were killed in a strike on their vehicles in central Gaza late yesterday. Manny will update us on what we know so far. Israel is also being named as having conducted an airstrike in Damascus that killed seven members of Iran's Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps, including the top Iranian commander in Syria. We'll hear more. Kanan observed Easter weekend celebrations in Haifa and in Jerusalem's Old City. We'll learn as well about Israeli Christians in general. We'll also hear about protests outside Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's residence in Caesarea, Caesarea, and how the neighbors feel about them. All this and much, much more when we're back.
The Technion Israel Institute of Technology is where some of Israel's brightest minds ask the biggest question of all. What if? What if they could take on the world's biggest challenges? What if they could develop life-changing environmental, scientific, health, medical, and technological discoveries that will make a huge impact on Israel and the planet? But they don't just ask the question, they answer it too. They turn those ideas into reality. They make them happen. To see just some of the incredible things they've achieved, get the Technion Booklet of Wonders at ats.org/wonders. We hope it inspires you to give them your support so they can keep doing what they do best. The American Technion Society. World-changing discoveries by Israel's brightest minds, made possible by you.
Seven aid workers with the World Central Kitchen Organization were killed in a strike on their vehicles in central Gaza late yesterday after they helped deliver food and other supplies to northern Gaza that had arrived hours earlier by ship. The source of fire could not be independently confirmed, but fingers are pointed at Israel. Manny, first of all, who were the victims? Who was hit?
The victims are, some of them are, dual citizens. So according to World Central Kitchen, they included citizens of Australia, Poland, the UK, a dual US-Canadian citizen, and the others were local Palestinians who were aiding the organization with their activities in Gaza. Like you mentioned, just hours earlier, they had delivered aid that had arrived to Gaza by ship. This is now the second ship that has brought in aid to Gaza via this organization, which has been involved in it. It's an independent group. It's not part of the UN or anything, which is what Israel's sort of been aiming to do and not work with UNRWA, and instead work with these other private organizations. And really, as of now, the fingers are pointed at Israel. The IDF says it is investigating the strike. It called it a tragic incident. It didn't really take responsibility for the incident yet. But it does appear to be that this was a strike carried out by Israel. There'll be a lot of questions now why the strike was carried out. Was there some sort of misidentification of this vehicle? We know that the vehicle itself was branded with the WCK logo. There'll be a lot of questions as to why this was carried out, or if this was a mistake or some other miscommunication or error. And that's something the army is investigating now.
As I understand it, it was two vehicles. And if it is not Israel, what other type of, I don't know, munitions could have potentially caused this strike?
I don't think that there's much of a doubt right now. There was an image circulated showing one of the vehicles, at least, that was hit. And it showed a sort of a large hole on the roof of the vehicle, which indicates the fire came from the air. It is unlikely that this was some other attack. And even so, the IDF has not said it was responsible, but it is investigating it at the highest levels, it said in a statement, to understand really why it was carried out. And I'm sure once they've figured out what happened, then they will take responsibility and definitely probably apologize for what happened.
As you mentioned, the World Central Kitchen is carrying out a pretty massive effort to get food throughout the Gaza Strip. And this ship carried 400 tons, whereas the previous ship had 200 tons. And as I understand it, they also have some 60 plus kitchens in southern and central Gaza cooking hundreds of thousands of meals each day, including Mejadra, according to the organization on Twitter. But is it so safe for them in these areas? The Strip is still a war zone. So how are they being protected when they have these 60 plus kitchens throughout the Strip?
I will say bluntly that it's not safe. And I think that the army says it is doing as best it can to ensure that they are protected. So when they are carrying out the distribution operations in northern Gaza, and or bringing the aid into the makeshift sort of jetty that was built in Gaza, the IDF is there to secure it, to ensure that none of them are hurt, and to make and also coordinate it so that the army does know where they are going, that knows where the aid is being taken for distribution. It would not surprise me if the army also knows where these kitchens are in the humanitarian zones as to not hit them. And that is really sort of the question around this strike, is whether or not Israel and the IDF or troops on the ground or whoever it was that carried out the strike knew that these were aid workers, knew that they were on some sort of mission at the time. And that's really where the problem is. And I would think that if a strike like this was carried out on a vehicle in central Gaza, then there may have been a misidentification, a miscommunication within the IDF as to what the target should have been, or they really had not coordinated the movement in that area prior.
Please check out our live blog for more updates on this. Israel is also accused by Iran of carrying out an airstrike yesterday on a building next to Iran's embassy in Damascus that killed seven members of Iran's Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps, including the top Iranian commander in Syria. Official Israel is not commenting on the strike, but who was the commander who was killed and what was his role?
The commander who was killed was named by the IRGC in a statement carried by Iranian media as Mohammad Reza Zahedi. And he is the most senior IRGC commander in Syria and the most senior IRGC commander killed or allegedly killed by Israel in Syria in recent years. I've seen some analysts comparing this to almost as significant as the American strike on Qassem Soleimani, the commander of IRGC in 2020. We're talking about a very senior commander, and according to reports, he was responsible for the operations of Quds Force, which is sort of the foreign arm of IRGC, in Syria and Lebanon. So that's the ties with all the Iran-backed militias in Syria and with Hezbollah in Lebanon, overseeing all of the sort of Iranian activity against Israel across the region. In addition to him, his deputy was also killed. So that's very significant too, since he was taken out and also his deputy. That leaves a large void there. And then there were five more commanders, IRGC commanders, who were in this building when it was hit. I won't name all of them, but they too were responsible for various parts of the Quds forces operations against Israel in the region. Just one more thing about the building. So according to Iranian media, this building is literally adjacent to the Iranian embassy. It's sort of part of the compound, and Iranian media said it was a part of the consulate and the residence of the ambassador. The ambassador wasn't there at the time of the strike. I believe he was back in Iran. And really, this is just a very significant strike against a building that really sort of belonged to the Iranian embassy. But in other senses, it wasn't really an embassy. It was being used by IRGC for their activities against Israel.
Early yesterday, the IDF withdrew from the Gaza City complex housing the Shifa Hospital after a two-week raid that you and I discussed on Sunday, in which the military said it detained or killed hundreds of terrorist suspects. So, Manny, now that the operation is over, what is the tally, as far as we know, of detained and killed suspected terrorists there?
According to the IDF, the total tally is 200 gunmen or terror operatives who were killed at Shifa or in the sort of surrounding area during the operation. Many of them were actually killed inside the hospital buildings themselves, but we're talking about the entire Shifa complex and some of the surrounding buildings. And then 500 confirmed terror suspects have been detained. In all, around 900 people were arrested by the IDF. They're still questioning many of them. So 500 are confirmed to be members of Hamas and Palestinian Islamic Jihad. And among those who were killed and detained, we're talking about several senior commanders in both Hamas and Palestinian Islamic Jihad, from which the IDF is managing to extract important intelligence, it says, that will help it for the rest of the war. And the army has described this as really one of the most successful operations in the war so far. If we talk about just a specific operation, it lasted around 2 weeks, slightly longer than I think the army initially expected, but also very, very successful considering how many members of the terror groups in Gaza they managed to capture and kill. Right now, the army has left it, the sort of withdrawn from the complex. The buildings are seen by Palestinians afterwards, once the army had left, have been heavily destroyed, very damaged. The army had accused Hamas of already demolishing or destroying the hospital during the operation. They had fired mortars and RPGs and set off explosives at the troops near the hospital. So that just you can see the aftermath of all the fighting there. And I think really, the army doesn't believe Hamas will again try to regroup there. It's wouldn't be sensible for them, but also just the infrastructure there is so damaged it wouldn't work. So the army will now wait for Hamas to try and regroup again in another area and probably carry out something similar in the coming months or even years as this war continues.
So, is the hospital still a hospital at all? Is it able to function?
I don't think most of it is able to function. I know that during the raid, the army evacuated all the hospital staff and civilians to a designated part of the complex, to a sort of another compound, where they then set up all the beds there and brought in humanitarian aid and equipment to allow them to continue functioning. But the other buildings, some of them I don't think are going to be, I don't think they can use them as a hospital in the near future.
Yesterday, a drone apparently launched from Iraq struck a building in a naval base in Israel's southernmost city, Eilat. And the IDF said that there was some kind of Iranian tie. What was it, Manny?
So this drone made its way from Iraq, apparently from Iraq, flew sort of across Jordan and then entered Israeli airspace just at Eilat and then struck this hangar. In Eilat, if you've ever been to Eilat, there's a very big hangar with an Israeli flag on it, just south of the sort of where the hotels are. That's the structure that was hit. There wasn't particularly significant damage, just the hangar was a little bit damaged, but no Navy vessels or any equipment was a hit. The IDF spokesperson, Daniel Hagari, said that the drone was Iranian-made, and that it sort of the attack was directed by Iran. Shortly after the explosion, a Iran-backed militia in Iraq claimed responsibility. It said it attacked a vital target in Israel with appropriate weapons, in quotes. They didn't elaborate further. They didn't say it was a drone, although overnight they did release a video showing it launching a drone, which it says was the one that they fired at Eilat. Amid the war, they've launched several drones at Israel, at least they claim. Many of them have fallen short, not reached Israel. A couple of them have been shot down, both in northern Israel and elsewhere. and at least one previously also hit an open area in the Golan Heights, which too caused some slight damage to nearby structures. But this is one of the more significant attacks that this group managed to carry out.
Manny, thank you so much for all of your updates, and we'll go to a short break.
Thank you.
I got married this Monday in the middle of a war.
You are not a soldier anymore. You are 50 years old. What is the matter with you?
It's like a couple of kilometers from here. Like, my friend has a 4x4. Let's just go cut across the fields and go get him.
Israel Stories, Wartime Diaries. Voices that try to capture slivers of life right now.
And he told me, take with you a sleeping bag and a tent and just go.
I texted him after I was told that he was killed.
From their eyes, I was a traitor.
Everybody needs their blankie, their teddy bear, something to make them feel safe.
I'm just another grandfather looking after his grandchild while his son is off at war.
These children of Hamas now will be the killer of my children.
I desperately wanted to talk about sex during my eulogy for Ido.
Everyone has to choose to be optimistic because we don't have room for pessimism.
Check out Israel Story wherever you get your podcasts.
And we're back. Kanaan, much of the Christian world observed Easter this past weekend, and you attended events in Haifa on Friday and Jerusalem on Easter Sunday itself. So what was the atmosphere like this year under war?
Very different atmospheres in both places. And the reason for that is that the one in Jerusalem hardly had any pilgrims. And usually on Easter, the holiest day on the Christian calendar, the Via Dolorosa, at least, and other parts of the old city are really crowded with pilgrims from all over the world, a lot of them Europeans, that come to commemorate on Good Friday the crucifixion of Jesus and to celebrate his resurrection on Easter Day.
So what you observed in Haifa was mostly local Christians, is that correct?
Right, and in Haifa, it was not that much affected by the war attendance. In fact, maybe, if anything, there were more people at one of the two processions we have. We have a Maronite church, which is an endemic Christian Assyric branch of Catholicism, and we have the mainstream Catholic procession. And in the Catholic one, a lot of the towns from the north, which is where most Christians live, they came to Haifa because their events got canceled for security reasons. So you have higher attendance there and lower attendance in the Maronite churches, perhaps because of the mood. Just people were not in the mood to congregate in Haifa. There's also a very vivid fear among Christians here of the Shiites in Lebanon. You know, we feel like we're in the crosshairs of Hezbollah. They feel it even more. And there was talk that some were afraid that there would actually be a strike on Haifa on Easter, especially to hurt them. They have a long, long tradition of conflict with Muslim sects in Lebanon. A lot of the Christians here in Haifa are actually originally from around the northern border, which is why they're Maronites. Maronites are concentrated in Lebanon.
Tell us more about the Christians who live here, the Israeli Christians.
Broadly speaking, they're a huge success story. We often get distracted by the tensions and racism and the issues that surround that population, but the Christians are smashing success story, and we see it. There are about 190,000 of them, and we in Israel, and we see it in, for example, university attendance, which is 20 points, about 55% for Arab Christians. It's 20 points above their Muslim counterparts, and also 15% above Christians who aren't Arab. So they have this tradition of higher education, of success. Unfortunately, they're also a declining minority because of the birth rate. They have a birth rate that's below replacement level at about 1.7, whereas Jews and Muslims are slightly above replacement level of 2.1.
But not only the birth rate is affecting the decline in population, as I understand it, many have fled in the past, 20 years at least.
some have emigrated for sure, but actually the fact that the numbers are stable, they have a decline of about 1.3% of the population per annum. The fact that it's more or less stable is because of Aliyah. A quarter of the Christians in Israel are Olim, coming here under the law of return because they're related to Jews, and then they identify as Christians here and they strengthen the local communities. And you can see that in Haifa too, which has, I think, about 20% of the population is Russian speaking. So you can see also the contingent of the Russian speakers among the local Arab populations. It's fascinating to watch. So whereas there is emigration because of the opportunities that the higher education affords them, there is also immigration that kind of balances the final count.
Really fascinating. Let's turn to another site visit that you made, and that is to Caesarea, where on Motzei Shabbat, the end of Shabbat, you attended a protest with, I don't know, hundreds, if not thousands of protesters who are standing outside our Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's private residence. What did you see there?
Well, they were kept at arm's length. We often, when we read about it, we think they're just outside. They're not. They're at some junction on Rothschild Road, which is a beautiful... I had a really culture shock coming there. So what a beautiful place. We corresponded about it too. So Rothschild Road crosses the dunes in the heart of Caesarea. And on either side, they're kind of... They're not gated communities, but they might as well be. It's enclaves, neighborhoods that are kind of circular and very much isolated from the rest of the city and from each other. And along that road, the protesters come for the past, I think, 5-6 weeks. They've come there to protest. And each time they pick a different spot along that scenic route to set up camp. And they pull out their amplifiers and their megaphones and start chanting. They come with the flags and the posters, and they do this. They change it up because it's harder for the police to break them up. It's a licensed protest, but not always. The number that show up, the turnout is a little bit flexible. Yeah, they have license for 1,000 people, and then 1,200 people come, and then police come. So they change it up, and there's the traditional attempt to breach through the police barricade, which is more symbolic than anything else, because they just run up to the barricade, and then the police say, "Okay, guys, enough, pack it up." Now, I spoke to the locals there, and they were kind of surprisingly split, because Caesarea is a very affluent place. You would expect to find a lot of sympathy there for the protesters. It should be noted that the protesters who come tend to be, this is my impression of them, tend to be middle-aged, affluent. You see it in the cars that are parked along Rothschild Road. And kind of from that crowd that you would associate with Caesarea. And you had a range of reactions. You could spot the locals by the dogs, because they came with their dogs to the protest. And among the dog owners, one of them, Limor Ben Chur, as she approached the protesters, started shouting, "Retards, go back home," and all kinds of insults. Another just joined in, Meital Yesuri, who is the head of the chapter, so she arranges the local activities. And of course, you have the Not In My Backyard crowd, which isn't about politics at all. I talked to one of them, El Adbek, a sports therapist, whom I saw rushing along Rothschild Road with his baby in the stroller. And a toddler. And the toddler asked him, "Dad, what are these people saying?" And he said, "Nonsense." And just rushed along. And later, on the way back, I kind of caught him and asked him how he felt. And he said, "I don't care about all of this. It's just impossible to live here. We have Saturday night curfews, we have short weekends, and they're cramping our style." So that was kind of it in Caesarea. And then there's the interaction with Or Akiva, which is a neighboring community, a whole different story. Our Likud stronghold, quite poor, mostly Sephardic. And there we've seen the friction between the two communities in the protests of 2023. It almost got violent, certainly. It got violent a couple of times. end. This time, because of the war, I guess it's a little bit tampered down, and still you see the Or HaKiva crowd, you know, cursing and showing their disapproval of the Kisaria protesters by riding the electric bike and shouting all kinds of insults at them. And in the end, toward the end, I met a guy from Or HaKiva who was standing on a roundabout with a sign that said "Sociopolitical Psychosis." And I asked him what that was about, and he said, "Well, of course, what we're seeing here is sociopolitical psychosis." And I told him, "Yeah, but do you mean the protesters or do you mean the government? What do you mean?" He said, "The protesters, of course." Well, the protesters kind of dug his message because they honked in approval whenever they passed. And then the Or HaKiva, his neighbors from Or HaKiva, told him to get lost. And in the end, we kind of agreed he needs a better sign.
Kanan, I feel almost as if I was there. Thank you so much for bringing that to us.
Thank you.
Thanks for joining us today for today's Daily Briefing. Please check out another installment tomorrow. This episode was produced by The Podwaves. If you have any questions or comments about this or any other episode, please drop an email to podcast@timesofisrael.com. Until tomorrow, shalom.